I'm Marty Moscone, and welcome to Radio Times. By all accounts, a woman endured a terrifying 40-minute ride on the L last week in Philadelphia when she was harassed and then raped while other passengers did nothing to stop the attack. No one intervened, no one called 911 or pushed the emergency button on the train. An off-duty transit worker did call 911, and within minutes, the man was arrested and the woman transported to a hospital. This horrifying incident has reignited a discussion about the bystander effect, groups of people who view a violent or disturbing incident and do not act. What prevents strangers from helping each other? Is that a common reaction? And conversely, what is it about the people who do intervene? What is a safe way to diffuse a high-conflict situation? We asked Catherine Sanderson to join us on Radio Times. She's chair and psychology professor at Amherst College, wrote a book titled Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. And Catherine Sanderson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this really important issue.
Absolutely. In fact, you had a piece in USA Today. Let me just read one of the couple of sentences that you wrote specifically about what happened on the L in Philadelphia last week. You wrote, "Most of us like to think of ourselves as good people and would surely step up in the face of bad behavior. Yet research in social psychology sadly reveals that most people, like those on the train in Philadelphia, in reality will not. What holds us back?"
Well, there are basically three factors, and I think all three might have come into play in Philadelphia. One, ambiguity. We're not exactly sure what we're seeing or hearing. Two, diffusion of responsibility. In a crowd, if there are other people there, we think, well, it doesn't have to be me. Surely it's someone else. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, fear of the consequences. If I intervene, might I get hurt myself?
Well, let me break each of those down. And as you say, ambiguity, I was not on that train, nor were you. Frankly, only a handful of people were on the train, and I haven't seen any video to know exactly what was happening. But it sounded like everything that I read is that this man was harassing this woman, eventually took off some of her clothes and raped her. What's ambiguity? How ambiguous is that?
So, again, you and I were not on the train, but I think there are a couple of puzzling details about this. One, I read in early reports that they got on the train at the same stop. I wondered if perhaps some people thought they were together, that they were actually a couple instead of a stranger. Research, in fact, has clearly shown that people are far less likely to intervene if they believe it's a domestic quarrel or a spat of some sort, even sexual assault, if they believe the people know each other. So I think that could be ambiguous, the nature of their relationship. It's also not clear on a train car, where were people sitting? So somebody sitting immediately behind them or beside them obviously would have been very aware of what was happening. But people who were 10, 12 rows away, perhaps with headphones on, they may not have really had a clear sense of what exactly was going on.
We did, apparently people were, or reportedly, I should say, were taking video or there was some kind of photography going on. Again, you know, I'm assuming that it was of this incident. I can't 100% say that that is true or frankly not. But if it were true, what does that tell you?
So it actually reminded me, those reports, of a scene that I believe many of us have seen. It happened on a United Airlines flight maybe 4 or 5 years ago, in which a plane was overbooked and transit officers at O'Hare pulled a man, dragged a man down the aisle.
I remember that.
And what do you remember that?
I do.
And here's why. You weren't on that plane,
right?
True?
No, I was not.
You remember it because everybody on the plane thought it was horrible. And they took out their phones and they videoed it. And as soon as they got off the plane, they uploaded it to social media. And that's why I can reference it right now and people know what I'm talking about. But again, as a social psychologist watching those images, what occurred to me was, why didn't somebody on the plane stand up and say, stop dragging this man down the aisle? Right? So they videoed it, but they didn't intervene. And so the challenge of cell phones is I have no idea why people would have videoed that instead of getting involved. Were they trying to produce evidence to the police? Are they turning that footage over? Or were they really being heartless and cruel and videotaping something truly terrible?
The other thing you referenced was just fear of consequences. And obviously, in a strange place with people that you do not know, you see something happening and you have to sort of evaluate, what can I do, or what should I do, or do I feel like I have the wherewithal to intervene to stop something without getting hurt myself?
And that is a realistic fear, right? We've seen examples of people who have done something courageous. I start my piece for USA Today about a story from Portland, Oregon, about three men who stood up and confronted somebody and intervened who was yelling racist slurs at two young women. And that man pulled out a knife and stabbed two of them, and two of them died. So I think it's also reasonable to assume that people on that train were afraid. It was 10 p.m. It was dark. They may not have known anyone else on the train who could help them. And they may well have feared, if I intervene, will I be attacked? Does that person have a knife?
Do we know? I mean, it's so easy to judge others. Do we know what we would do under those circumstances?
So to me, I think that's such an important point, because I believe all of us like to think, I would be the one who would stand up. I would be the one who would call 911. And there are some people who, in fact, are those people. I think it's not an accident at all that the person who ultimately called was an off-duty transit officer, right? That person felt a special sense of responsibility. So they couldn't just say someone else will do it. They had a sense of, oh, wait, this is kind of my job in that sense. What research shows is that there are some people who do step up. I call them moral rebels. And those people seem to have three characteristics in common. One, they seem to be high in empathy, so they really can put themselves in somebody else's shoes. Two, they're low in fear of embarrassment. They don't worry about overreacting or feeling embarrassed for looking stupid. And three, they have some kind of training. So often they've had military training, or they've had a CPR or first aid class. They have a sense of responsibility, and that probably gives them greater confidence that they know what to do and that they can help effectively.
Help us understand the embarrassment part, the fear of embarrassment if you intervene in a situation where someone is in trouble. What are we embarrassed by?
So this happens all the time, that people fear that they are misinterpreting a situation. So the sort of classic and tragic example is what happens in deaths by fraternity hazing or alcohol abuse in college students. Overwhelmingly, students think, oh, well, he's probably just drunk and he's probably just going to sleep it off. It's probably not a big deal. But then they have a friend who's unconscious, and each individual person might think, this is a problem. Maybe we should call 911. But you don't want to be the person who overreacts and does that. And then it's just, oh, he was going to sleep it off. He's just drunk. It's no big deal. And so there's a pretty natural human tendency to be afraid of misinterpreting and overreacting and feeling stupid for intervening.
Well, we're talking about, let me just reference, because I know that happened with your son, right, in college?
It did. So the prompt for me to really start writing and talking about this topic was, my son started college just about 4 years ago now. 2 weeks into his first semester, a student died in his dorm. Mm. And when Andrew called and told me the story, it just broke my heart. It was, a student was drinking on a Saturday. He fell and hit his head. His friends watched over him for hours because they wanted him to be okay. They put him in bed, made sure he was still breathing. They strapped a backpack around his shoulders to prevent him from rolling onto his back and vomiting and choking to death. So again, these were nice kids who wanted their friend to be okay. But what they didn't do for 19 hours was call 911. Sure. And when they finally did call, it was too late.
So good people can do either bad things or stupid things.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I think that the quote of the appalling silence of the good people is really apt in this situation, that there are many situations in which people see something, hear something problematic, and it's not that they're the one doing the behavior. They're not the people who are actively doing something harmful, you know, racist, homophobic, etc. But if it's not called out and other people around them stay silent, then things continue.
What's so interesting, and this is research that you've looked at and other people have done and you have done yourself, which is that when we're in a crowd, it actually inhibits us from intervening. And that seems counterintuitive. You think, you know, we're all together, we're in a group, we're all witnessing this terrible incident. Let's go do something about it. It doesn't seem to work that way.
Well, right. Well, and I think that is counterintuitive, right? Because you would think that. So I'll say a couple things. One, in a crowd, there is a feeling of diffusion of responsibility. It's why students don't like group projects, right? They might have to be the sucker who does more of the work. It's why restaurants impose a mandatory tipping fee on parties of five or six or more, because people are stingier in a group setting because their own meager contributions will even out. In a group setting, there's also more people who can potentially observe us misinterpreting and looking stupid and feeling embarrassed. So we're less likely to help. Now, the one important exception is if you have a friend with you in the situation. So you have somebody who you can say, hey, do you see what's going on? Or, hey, what'd you think of that? Or whatever. If you have somebody who's an ally who you feel comfortable with, it's actually more likely for people to intervene if they have a friend with them. And I think that is hopeful for all of us.
Indeed. Does it also raise questions that we might be more likely to intervene if we're by ourselves versus if we're in a group of strangers?
Absolutely. And what would be fascinating, I think, is if on that train there had been the sexual assault happening and just one person on that train car, that person couldn't have said, oh, well, probably somebody else has already called 911, or probably somebody else is going to do something. Or even, I guess it's no big deal because look at all these other people not reacting. If there had been one person on that train car, the odds, in fact, are that that woman would have received much more prompt intervention.
I'm thinking of that woman. We don't know her name and what she endured for those 40 minutes. And if what you're describing is correct, is that people were observing what was going on, but they weren't acting, the impact on her as she was being assaulted by this man.
Well, absolutely. And I think in some sense, you know, that's going to be the hardest thing for people on that train to have known what they did was not only ignore it, but it seems at least some people on that train were almost participating in a way. I remember a horrible story I read about a number of years ago in which a person in San Francisco was on the ledge of a building threatening to jump. And a bunch of people on the ground just took out their cell phones and started videoing. And some of them started shouting, you know, jump or do it or something. And I just think to myself, how could you live with yourself for being somebody who not only didn't intervene, but may have played a role in reinforcing the horrific behavior?
In fact, he did jump, right?
He did.
He did. Yeah. We're almost up in a break where does it help us explain things like lynch mobs, stuff like that?
Absolutely. And again, I think what you see in the case of lynch mobs, and this is something that I have written about in depth, is that in lynch mobs, each individual person may be thinking, this is horrible, this is awful, but they look around at everybody else. And because nobody else is responding out of concern, other people just go along and get swept away.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Catherine Sanderson. She's chair and psychology professor at Amherst College, wrote a book called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. And we called her up to join us on Radio Times because of what happened last Wednesday night on an L in Philadelphia. A woman was sexually assaulted. Apparently, there were people on the L who did not act. The man has been arrested. She was taken to a hospital. We don't know how she is doing, but nonetheless, it raises a whole host of questions about what's called the bystander effect. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guest Catherine Sanderson about the bystander effect, the psychology behind why we fail to act when we see a problematic event or a violent situation, how to speak up and help others in all kinds of difficult situations. We'll be talking about that, including racial or sexual harassment and physical assault. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, and we definitely do want to hear from you. Carol Sanderson, let me ask you about a study that's gotten a fair amount of play by a researcher, Richard Philpott. It was titled, Would I Be Helped? And apparently he and his colleagues put a bunch of CCTV cameras in different countries. In fact, I believe they were in Amsterdam and in Cape Town and in Lancaster in the UK, just to see how people were going to respond to a real-life violent incident. Would they intervene or not? And according to his study and the findings, something like 90% of the people did. Now, that seems to go a little counter to what you're saying about how people act in public.
So that study got a lot of attention, and I think rightly so. It was really a very, very important finding. But I think there are a few things that are distinct about that. One, what he was looking at were violent attacks. So, you know, fist fights, et cetera, outside bars, I think, basically. And so the challenge is that when you see a physical fight occurring in that way, no one thinks it's ambiguous, that is pretty clear that this is a problem, somebody getting beaten up. So the fear of ambiguity is decreased. So that's one. Two, in those settings, it's very likely that people are coming across a situation with a friend. So if you're partying late at night, you know, with friends coming out of a bar, et cetera, it's much more likely that you have somebody with you. And so the idea that I talked about before of having an ally might also be helpful. And then the final thing, which he did not look at, but I've always wondered about that study, is that a lot of the incidents that he was describing were in fact happening late at night. We talked before about the issue of embarrassment. What research has shown is that people who are drunk actually have a lower inhibition, right? Because they're less worried about being embarrassed because of the alcohol. So I actually have wondered if those effects in part might be driven by people being with friends and a little bit tipsy.
But what you're also, and you referenced this earlier, so when a situation is ambiguous, people maybe stand on the sidelines. But when it's a true emergency, they're more likely to intervene?
They are. And that's frankly why we see acts of tremendous heroism. So after the Boston bombing marathon occurred, overwhelmingly, there were people who rushed in and helped people who were severely injured. We see this in the case of school shootings, in which teachers and other students and coaches are heroic in terms of charging the gunmen or blocking the door and so on. Because if there are bombs, if there are guns, there's no ambiguity. So all of a sudden, the fear of feeling stupid or embarrassed is gone because you immediately recognize this is a true emergency. The challenge becomes in the case of more ambiguous situations where you don't really know how to interpret it.
Help us understand, I mean, does understanding how the brain works under these circumstances, does that help us explain behavior?
It does. And this is really fascinating recent research from social neuroscience. What research has now shown is that the part of the brain that is activated when you experience social pain, so being rejected, being ostracized by your group, the part of the brain that is activated when you have social experiences, social pain, is the exact same part of the brain that is activated when you experience physical pain, when you have a paper cut or spill hot coffee on your arm or step on a tack. And so what that research tells us is that we are probably hardwired to avoid pain. And that means that we really fear being rejected or deviating from our group in some way. And it's one of the factors that probably inhibits people from speaking out in cases in which they fear the social consequences.
Because the group is so important to us to feel belong, that we belong.
It is. It's an inherent fundamental human need.
Let me get one of our listeners to join our conversation. And this is Chris. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, how's it going, Marty? Longtime fan.
Thanks so much, Chris. Go ahead.
Okay, so I was an Uber driver about a year ago, full time. I was in North Philly. I picked up a ride. I had about three passengers. We're driving, and out of nowhere, the passenger next to me starts beating me in the face. Just out of nowhere, out of the blue. We're in the middle of Temple's campus, very well lit, tons of students around. I pull over, obviously, I stop the car. We both get out of the car and we start fighting. I hit him, he hits me. He very verbally says, I'm going to steal your car, I'm going to steal your car. People just start filming us. There must have been 20 people filming us. Nobody did anything. ended up kicking the guy out of the car, kicking the two other people out of the car, driving away. I had actually left my hat. So I come back around about 2 minutes later, and I'm just like in a daze, and I go get my hat to the people who are filming me. I go, did you do anything? And they said, we thought it might have been a movie. And it dawned on me when...
You know, Chris, we don't, I'm so sorry. We don't have a great phone line with you. I appreciate, first of all, I'm really glad that you called, and I'm sorry you had to experience this, but I do want to give our guests a chance to respond to that about how we might misperceive what's happening right in front of us on the street. What do you say?
Well, so I think the last part of his sentence was, we thought it was a movie,
right?
And so that is a fascinating sort of interpretation that I do wonder to what extent, you know, sort of reality shows in which people are being punked or whatever have led people to think, you know, maybe this is a joke or maybe this isn't real. The other just sort of mildly practical advice that I wanted to give to Chris is that what research has shown pretty powerfully is that in situations in which there are lots of people around and you have this diffusion of responsibility and ambiguity, a really good thing to do is to identify a single person and specifically to tell them what to do. So to say, you in the red shirt, I need help, call 911.
Oh.
And that way you've immediately given one person instruction. So you're not sort of hoping somebody will step up. You've told a person, a specific person to help, and you've also told them exactly what to do. So they don't have to think, oh, what's the right thing? Does he want me to come over and help, et cetera? So there are things that if we are the victim, research has shown we can do that will increase the likelihood that we actually will get help.
Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm sorry we had some trouble with your phone line. You know, I'm thinking of people either calling 911 or not calling 911. And for some people, calling the police is not part of their repertoire. They don't feel as if the police are there to protect them. How does that figure into our conversation?
So that's a really important and, of course, very sad statement. But that is also true. And I think there may well be times in which people fear if I call 911 and a police officer comes, will something get worse? You know, will somebody be shot? You know, will somebody be accused of doing something that they did not? Will they think it's me who was the, you know, person who was engaging in the bad behavior, et cetera? So I do think that in certain parts of the country, in certain cities in particular, there may be intense fear about calling 911. And again, if you're also worried about directly intervening because you might get hurt and you don't feel it's safe to call 911 because of the potential consequences, that's really a horrific setting.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you and make sure our listeners can join our conversation. That's Catherine Sanderson. She wrote a book called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. She's a psychology professor, chair of psychology at Amherst College. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And like Chris, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Catherine Sanderson, here's a comment from Patrick. He says, very sad and unfortunate situation, talking about what happened on the L. He says, what we're experiencing here in Philadelphia, that violence has become the order of the day. And, you know, sadly, like a lot of big cities in this country, we are experiencing this terrible uptick in violence and gun violence. And you know, it's you don't want to get used to it, but nonetheless, here we are.
Well, and I think it's natural for people to worry, if I had stepped up, if I had intervened, if that person took out a gun, would I potentially have paid for that with my life? And so I do think that the presence of guns pretty much everywhere may make it harder for people to feel comfortable stepping up, because the fear of the consequences start weighing very heavily, and rightly so.
Is race a factor, whether people do or don't intervene, either the race of the perpetrator, the race of the victim, the race of the bystander?
So there's not particularly great research sort of teasing out all of the different effects. But what research in sociology has clearly demonstrated is that people are more likely to help if they feel they are in a safe and environment, a safe neighborhood in which they have trust of people around them. And again, that may well be because if you help someone who's in need and that person turns out to have a gun, or that person is swindling you in some way, there are consequences. And so what research, again, in sociology has clearly shown shown is that people are more likely to give help in communities in which they feel safe, in which there is high level of trust. And that tends to be communities that are more affluent.
Oh, but I'm wondering, you know, in a city like Philadelphia, very diverse city, I've ridden the L like most people. I'm probably listening to this show. So when you have a mix of people on a public transportation system, how does race factor in there?
So people overwhelmingly are more likely to help those who they feel empathy for, who they feel connection to. And so I think the key thing in any crowded situation in which you are inherently with strangers is, do you identify with the people around you? And in particular, do you identify with the victim who's in need of help? I have a friend who has a daughter who's Chinese, and she was on a crowded bus in Boston shortly after the coronavirus pandemic started. And a man on the bus stood up and started yelling, "You should go back to China, and you and your people brought us the coronavirus pandemic," etc. The bus was crowded, and as my friend described, not a single person told the man to shut up. Not a single person, you know, said for him to be quiet. And again, if it was my daughter on that bus, I'd really like somebody to step up. So I think one of the issues is, do we identify with the person who's in need? And that could be about race, but it could also be about gender. It could be about age. It could be even, are you wearing a particular t-shirt or sweatshirt where, oh, you know, we root for the same sports team, or we went to the same college. So again, it can be across any sort of identity, as long as what you're doing is feeling a sense of connection and empathy for the person who's in need.
Do you think we're living in a time where people feel more emboldened to insult or harass other people? I mean, anecdotally, it feels that way, but I don't know research-wise whether it does.
So there is certainly some research suggesting that over the last few years, people, in fact, have become more emboldened. There are certainly reports from teachers that bullying has become more common in schools. And that's frankly why I think information about how to put a stop to it, because even in cases in which there is bullying or sexual misconduct, et cetera, many people find it problematic. So if you look at bullying as a particular example, many people find bullying problematic, and yet they don't speak up, and they assume that other people are kind of okay with it. So talking about the psychology of inaction and what more people actually do think and feel is a really important part of giving people the courage to speak up. Because if you know that other people will support you speaking up, on that train in Philadelphia, if one person had have stood up and said, "Hey, you know, this is a problem," or "Hey, stop this," I bet other people would have joined. Yeah. The problem was, you needed one.
You needed one. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a comment from Emily. She says, "In my own experience in our everyday lives, it helps to practice advocacy in little ways, like doing something small to take action that helps someone else, so that you're more prepared when an incident like this," the one we've been talking about, "has happened. It's hard to go from 0 to 911. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely do. And thank you for that. Was that Emily? Was that Emily's comment?
Yes.
Yeah. That's, in fact, exactly what the research shows. Overwhelmingly, I have people say to me, you know, this thing happened, and then I didn't know what to do. And then 2 days later, I was in the shower, and I was like, oh, that's what I should have said, or that's what I should have done. So Emily is exactly right, that if you play through ahead of time, okay, here's what I could do, here's what I could say, here's how I could act, then you're more likely to be able to call up that desired common action approach in the moment. Practice really does make a difference.
And can we assume that if we're feeling a certain ambivalence and perhaps wishing we had done something to intervene, that other people are as well?
Absolutely. And so, again, having the sense of, I'm not alone here, that I might be feeling awkward or embarrassed and not knowing what to do, but knowing that it's not just me, that other people around me are having the same kind of concerns. It's very normal. That can actually help reduce inhibition that drives action.
Well, let me read a comment from Beth. She says, "Years ago, I witnessed a woman screaming and physically hurting her small child. I ran up to the mother and I yelled at her. She yelled profanities at me and continued to drag her child. She followed me and threatened me. How should I have handled this situation differently for the safety not only of the child, but of myself as well?"
I get comments about observing bad behavior towards children all the time, and it's always, as a mom, very heartbreaking. So I think there are a couple different things. I think in some cases, if there's concern that the child is being mistreated or abused, a call reporting that person to the authorities can well be effective. I've also thought that sometimes just interrupting a scene, so going over and saying, oh, you know, I've had a hard day too, or it's hard being a mom, or playing peekaboo with a child, or just doing something to interrupt the scene can be helpful. But again, I think it really varies depending on who you are and the situation and your own safety.
But what you're saying, and not to necessarily criticize our listener, is to say it probably doesn't make sense to yell at the woman, but to say, look, I know how you're feeling. I have little kids too. I've been frustrated. I've been at the end of my rope.
In that particular situation, it is probably better to try to de-escalate. And so doing some kind of, and what she did is very natural and very normal. She may well have been a mom as well. And it was really horrific. So I think we can all understand her immediate gut response. What the research would tell us is that doing something to disrupt the situation by distracting, oh, you know, look, here's a balloon or something, to distract the attention and or to show connection with the mom. Hey, you know, listen, I could sit with your kid for a minute if you need to, you know, go finish that shopping, you know, hey, let's do peekaboo. Something to disrupt it and sort of build an ally might be a better way of diffusing the situation.
I always wonder in those situations, you know, when, let's say in this case, when the woman and the child go home, then what happens to the child when they're home alone?
Well,
not out in public.
And that's why, again, in some cases, if it appears that this is a child who is being treated poorly all the time, as opposed to a parent who just sort of, you know, had a momentary, you know, lapse, that calling authorities can be effective.
Right, right. And again, we're almost up in a break here, but there is sort of a reluctance, I think, to get the authorities involved. It just feels like you've sort of handed something over to an institution that you, in a sense, have no control over.
That is true, although I'm also reminded of a story a few weeks ago, and again, this happens with some regularity, of children who have been abused by parents and have died, and neighbors have reported it or family members have reported it, and the child really needed somebody to step in and intervene because ultimately they died.
Well, let's take that second break here on Radio Times. And again, talking with Catherine Sanderson. She's chair and psychology professor at Amherst College. Wrote a book called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. And we called her up after reading about a horrifying incident on the L in Philadelphia last week. A woman was sexually assaulted. Bystanders did not intervene, raising, of course, a whole host of questions about why people don't do that. And we're going to talk more about how to intervene after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Catherine Sanderson about the bystander effect and what it takes to be a responsible stranger when you see someone is in trouble or being assaulted, as what happened last week in Philadelphia. We want to expand the conversation, talking about things like hate speech and being verbally harassed and how we should intervene. And joining us now is Dax Valdez, senior trainer for Hollaback. That's a nonprofit that works to end harassment in all its forms. And Dax Valdez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I should say he is joining us by Skype. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dax, there are the five Ds that are part of this training that you do: distract, delegate, document, delay, and direct. I think we were talking with Catherine Sanderson about distract, how you, if you see an incident, the idea of trying to sort of interrupt that incident to begin to kind of diffuse it by distracting from it. Anything else you want to add to that?
So distract, it provides an opportunity just to disrupt the situation, because then other people who are perhaps observing the situation, they might already be thinking of what to do in order to support the person who is being harassed or disrespected. So in the case of the child, maybe it is something like, oh, I like your shoes. Can you tell me about like what's on them? Or I like the animals on your backpack. exactly, like focusing on the child, which then might give the parent a moment to step back and take a breath and collect themselves. And as Professor Sanderson said, it might just be a momentary lapse.
Sure.
We don't know what is happening at that moment, but focusing on the child will disrupt the situation. Maybe, and then maybe another parent comes by and has a small child that they can just talk or interact with. And that is enough of a distraction in that moment.
Well,
and then I also,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that Professor Sanderson also said, like, as bystanders, it is really contingent on us, our personality, and our comfort level. So what we do with the 5Ds is it is scaled to the individual's comfort level, whatever they feel safe and comfortable doing at that moment to support the person who is being harassed.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's a very important point because you're dealing with people that you do not know. Let me throw out another D, and the idea is to delegate, which is part of the training, which is to ask for assistance. And that's something, Catherine Sanderson, that you mentioned as well. But Dax, flesh that out for us.
So delegate allows us to speak up when we don't feel comfortable elevating our own voice. So in the case of something like the our Uber driver who mm-hmm. was saying that everybody was filming, but nobody was doing anything because they thought it was a movie or they thought it was something else. And Professor Sanderson said, yes, if you focus on one person and tell them what you need them to do. So with document, we really recommend a combination of delegate and document. So that is telling somebody, hey, can you go get help while I document this or make sure that something else is being done? And then what we recommend that you do if you are recording or taking a picture of the incident in public space is that you give that footage to the person who's experiencing the harassment so that they can decide what to do with it. So that way we're not sharing their trauma all over the internet without their consent or without their permission, because it is a traumatic experience. And delegate is really powerful in helping you feel supported as an observer, as a bystander, as well as taking care of the person who's experiencing the conflict. And we can tell other people what to do because
sure.
people want to help. They sometimes just don't know what to do. So, hey, can you go tell the manager what's happening? Hey, that man in the red shirt, he keeps harassing me. Can you take out your phone and can you record him? And if you are in a position to tell people what you need, if you are experiencing that harassment, that is a little bit more agency that you have to reclaim your space, to make sure that you are doing what you need to feel supported in that moment. And when multiple people are intervening, it does create this network and environment of safety.
Absolutely.
Dax, and perhaps.
Yeah, no, Dax.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Hold on. I just want to get Catherine Sanderson back in on the conversation. Anything else that you would suggest in terms of, you know, assessing the situation and figuring out how to intervene and whether to intervene?
So I really like all of those examples just described. And I will also point out that the reason why we know what happened in Minneapolis to George Floyd is that people were filming, right? Is that people were documenting.
Yes.
And so there are cases in which documenting can, in fact, be a really important strategy. And in particularly in cases, again, in Minneapolis, where you don't want to intervene because it's the police. And so intervening against the police, of course, feels very, very different. So the key is, when you're in a situation and you don't know what to do or how to interpret it, having somebody say, hey, you do this, I'm going to do this, this is what needs to happen, immediately it reduces a feelings of, oh, it's not my responsibility. It also clears up any ambiguity that bystanders might have about exactly what's going on. And in some cases, documenting can provide valuable evidence.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of the Chauvin murder trial when those witnesses who did document what was happening to George Floyd, you know, were just in absolute abject tears, Catherine Sanderson, because they felt they had not done enough. I mean, what they did was to document it and show the world what happened to George Floyd. But for them, it wasn't enough.
Well, and obviously, in some senses, it wasn't enough because George Floyd died. And that's something, again, that the witnesses in that situation felt that they were doing something. They did, in fact, bring the officers who were involved to justice, that they, in fact, will receive punishment. Whereas if those witnesses had not videoed, George Floyd would still be dead, but those officers would still be working for the Minneapolis police. And I think it's also important, we have focused on the role of bystanders who are strangers in a situation. But my focus, in fact, in the George Floyd case, and I wrote a piece for USA Today about this that was published last year, is that we also have the responsibility to not be bystanders if that's our own colleagues. And there were four officers in the case of George Floyd's death. One was kneeling on his neck, but there were three others. And if those three officers had have pulled off Derek Chauvin, George Floyd would be alive today. So bystanders are not just strangers on public transportation. In some cases, we can be bystanders to bad behavior being carried out by our friends and colleagues.
We got a bunch of comments here, and I want to put them both to both you, Catherine Sanderson, and to Dex Valdez. John says, is this more societal than human psychology oriented? It seems that it is more related to our culture, which includes a lot of social media. Dex, we were talking about, the role of social media and cell phones and things like that. How much do you think social media plays a role either in exacerbating these situations or maybe, actually helping to deal with them?
It is a double-edged sword there. I think it's bringing awareness for sure. We are definitely hearing and seeing and receiving more incidents of harassment because of the prevalence of social media, but also with people sharing their own stories, it lets people know that they are not the only ones experiencing it. Right. And by sharing your story, it is building empathy and perhaps gives permission for other people to speak up about what has happened to them. And so if it's related to an individual who is committing these behaviors, maybe then it is more immediately addressed. And just for people around the world having resources or a story sharing site like on our platform, iHollaBack.org, where you can share your story, get support from other people who have experienced harassment as well. And it is like one of the first steps in empathy building. So
no question. No, and to be someone who is being harassed and to have someone step in and intervene and to help them, that's got to discount for so much, Dax.
And I would say even like the little thing of sometimes the moment of harassment is so fast. So maybe somebody is driving by in a car and yells a racial slur out the window.
Yeah.
They're gone. We've overheard it. We can use something like delay and go up to that person and say, are you okay? Because maybe the other times that happened to them, they did not have somebody check in on them. And maybe the next time it happens to them, nobody is going to say something. But at that moment, we're able to shape their experience of this instance of harassment and make a lasting impact.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Let me read a comment from Eileen. She says, an incident happened to me in the early 80s on SEPTA. This is our public transportation system here in Philadelphia. There were a bunch of businessmen coming home in rush hour, and no one did anything to intervene with what was happening with all these men around. I always want to ask, what if that was your wife that this was happening to or your daughter? Catherine, anything you want to say back to Eileen?
I think it exactly illustrates the point about empathy, right? That we always want to think, if it were me, if it was my daughter, if it was my wife. I mean, I remember thinking, if it was my son who was lying unconscious, I would not have wanted his friends to wait 19 hours to call 911. So this is the reason I'm so glad we're having this conversation, is that it could be any of us. It could be ourselves. It could be our loved ones. And that's why it's so very important that we are not the people who stay silent in the face of all different types of bad behavior. It could be any of us, any of our loved ones.
And would it be fair to say, Catherine Sanderson, that once you intervene once, you're more likely to do it again?
Yes, because part of it is that we have this fear of, if I intervene, I'm going to feel stupid or embarrassed or whatever. And once we do it, we actually feel proud. We feel good. And it inspires us and increases our confidence that we can do so effectively. So basically activating our inner moral rebel and taking little steps in the right direction can be really important. And again, it doesn't have to be, charging somebody with an assault rifle or, jumping into a car and, pulling out a baby. It can be something very subtle. So the example given before, coming up to someone and saying, hey, are you okay? Or this isn't okay. Or, hey, I find that problematic. So again, little steps in the right direction make a big difference.
Dex, I heard you say yes.
Yeah, it is. It's just flexing that muscle. It is practice. So, there are some strategies available to you. what you could say in this situation, or you could think about how you might react. Hey, stop talking to them like that. That's inappropriate. Those are some ways to state what's going on, the behavior that you want to stop, and then turn your focus and turn your attention and take care of the person who's experiencing the disrespect and that harassment. And again, like even those little things, as you get more comfortable with who you are and step into your own power, that can go a long way. And then other people who watch you do that might give themselves permission to say, oh yeah, that's something that I could do as well. And then in turn, it becomes a ripple effect.
Well, and I mean, and that gets back to something, Catherine, that you were saying, which is that even when people don't intervene, they're probably all thinking some of the same thing, which is, you know, what should I do? Or gosh, I wish I knew what to do.
Right. And so understanding even this discussion right now, that in many different situations, there are a group of people all thinking this is problematic, but not a single person verbalizes what they're thinking or feeling. And so in that case, we're looking to other people for guidance on how to interpret a particular situation. But because no person is speaking up about their hesitancy, they don't understand how universal their feeling of this is problematic is. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to call out bad behavior, because when one person does it, other people then learn that their feelings are shared and they're not alone. Each of us individually might feel alone, even though everyone in the situation is thinking and feeling the exact same thing.
We are talking about how to overcome the bystander effect, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a couple of more comments. Dax, I'll put this to you. This is a tweet from Catherine. She says, this reminds me of a mugging I witnessed in New York City. Everyone stood around and watched. Only two of us yelled for the police. Only two of us stuck around to make a report. I mean, that's frankly, the more depressing side of this conversation. But, you know, it's a problem when the bystander effect is, in a sense, in effect.
Mm. Yeah, and I think also, like, I've lived 18 years in New York, and the first couple of years, I would say like the first 15 or so, you know, just put your head down, mind your business, keep on going. But knowing that in certain situations, you may have an advantage. You may have more privilege in a situation which allows you to speak up, because the other person who is being harassed may not feel comfortable speaking up, or because of the area that they're in. So I think Professor Sanderson said more people are likely to step up when they feel they are in an area where they could be supported, where they are comfortable. But knowing that we all have a certain amount of power and privilege, depending on the space we're in, we can use that to our advantage. So the two people who stuck around and made that report felt comfortable enough to, number one, speak up and say something, and they're doing what they think is the right thing in that moment, which is to take care of the person who was mugged. So just being aware of that, the privilege that we have as we go through life, that is one thing to, I think, keep at the forefront of our minds as we interact with people.
Absolutely. And very, very powerful. Catherine, we're almost out of time here, but Michael wanted to know, is intervention of bystanders, is that different in different cultures? Have you looked at that?
I have not, but certainly the research that you described before in terms of Philbot's research in different countries would suggest that it looks very similar. And we can see examples across the world of cases in which bystanders have not stepped up. So it seems to be much more about a human phenomenon than a particular culture.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Catherine Sanderson, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us for the full hour.
Thank you so much for having this very important conversation, which I do think has the potential to make a real difference.
That's why we do the show, and I appreciate that. She's chair psychology professor at Amherst College and author of a book called Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels. And Dax Valdez, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed listening to the conversation, and hopefully people are inspired to learn more and take action.
Absolutely. Senior trainer for Hollaback. That's a nonprofit that works to end harassment in all its forms. We appreciate all the calls and comments to Radio Times. You can go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.